Long past the hour for quitting labor, amid the smoke-filled haze of the south gate, the after-lodge crew continues to linger in the rubbish of the temple, under the watchful eyes of Right Worshipful Grand Censor Bob. Not recognized nor endorsed by any grand or subordinate lodge of regular masons, irregular masons, co-masons, Canadian masons, or internet wannabe masons, they banter on as always. Puffing cigars, drinking stale coffee, making terrible jokes, studying agency law, spreading the intemperance and excesses of digital masonry, and generally disappointing all 7 of their podcast subscribers. Do yourself a favor and stop listening now. Only trolls and masochists dare to eavesdrop upon this After Lodge banter.
Lace him up, shadow boxing in the basement, speed bag. Time to land a spaceship. Heavy hitter, ducking punches, fighting the enemy. Who is the enemy? Can I survive me? I'm going in, I'm going under. Touch like lightning, roar like thunder. My legs are shaky, will I make it? I can't lie anymore. I can't fake it, no more running, I can't take it. Crack open, learn to take it. Pulling the rake over my heart, I can taste it. Going in circles, return to the burn. Am I moving forward? What have I learned? Give glory to the heavens and the earth. I walk the dirt, flirt with death, taste the breath of the devil while you move with the rest. More or less, it's time we score, we won this test. So let your chest take a rest and let your breath be the sound that lets us nest in the sound and then drowns in the now. It's the light of the first 6 days of creation. How far can you go?
Welcome to episode 150 of the After Lodge podcast, brought to you from a tiny little Google Hangouts channel in the corner of the internet. We are missing our technical prowess this week, as worshipless producer Bruce could not join us. He was whining something about packages and Christmas time, and he had a real grinchy face on. I don't know why mailmen are so unhappy this time of year. So this evening, I am joined by our, do I still call you Reverend? No? Okay.
Who are you referring to?
I'm referring to you, our former lodge chaplain.
Oh, bull crap. I am still the lodge chaplain. I am the lodge chaplain until somebody is installed in my place, and nobody has yet been installed.
Okay.
Just because
okay.
You've
That's
been
fair
elected,
enough.
You know, until they are installed, I still have 100% control of who gets in and who doesn't.
All right. Well, that'll be Saturday. So I guess we'll still call you Reverend because it works for the show.
Yeah. Hey, quick question.
Yep.
If I don't show up Saturday, then my replacement can't be installed and I could.
Oh, yes, serve he can.
How? I can take the apron home with me and the jewels and you have to sit there naked.
Great.
And then you'll have a naked chaplain.
So the question is, are you still going to be able to use the moniker the Angry Chaplain on future episodes of this podcast?
Actually, I think I'm just going to be a grumpy past master at this point.
Oh.
I could be the grumpy past master formerly known as chaplain. I'll be like Prince.
Got it. So we also are joined again by Brother Nick, who I'm going to dub Assistant Producer Nick, or Swim Bike Run Run, as you might know him on the Freemasonry subreddit.
It's funny. David and I were like, when are we going to start overstaying our welcome? Like, Harlan's like, and Nick and David are here again?
No, it's all good. We welcome all to the After Lodge podcast.
Glad to be here.
But Nick is going to be spinning the dials and running us some interference with the IRC channel, which we are live streaming in again. If you brothers haven't taken the hint thus far, IRC is where you want to be, because I feel like we're going to keep doing this, and you're missing out on my beautiful face and whatever the chaplain may not be wearing on a given episode. So if you want to see the video, you got to be on the IRC channel, at least till we change our minds.
I need to go put on pants.
Oh, nice. We also have Brother David Riley joining us again, backed by popular demand.
I'm increasingly unsure that you want to see the video.
Well, this is what you guys were all missing out on before we started doing the video live stream. Was this is what we had to deal with every week. He would show up in some various stage of undress and turn the camera on. The episode 139, I think it was, when he was in Charlotte, and that whole scene happened on the show where he took us into the bathroom because he had to go. Like, that wasn't show acting. Like, he really took the phone with the video camera into the bathroom. It was very uncomfortable for us. So, and then our special guest this week, sorry, Brother Riley, but you can only be the special guest once, so, is none other than Brother Chuck Dunning out of somewhere in the great state of Texas.
Yeah, to be exact.
Fort Worth. Good, good. So it's the sunny side of Dallas.
Yes.
Got it. So Brother Dunning is the author of Contemplative Masonry, a book on mindfulness and the craft, which we will, I'm sure, be getting into later in the show. But before we do that, I thought I would ask if anybody did anything exciting that they would like to share with our 7 podcast subscribers.
I went to the longest, coolest, most exhausting lodge meeting I've ever been to in my life.
Is this the one you were chatting with me in, like, Sunday night or Saturday night, whenever it was?
We don't allow cell phones in the lodge, so I wasn't chatting with you.
Got it. Got it.
You don't allow cell phones in your lodge, for real?
No.
No.
We don't either, then. as soon as lodge opens, we usually are all checked into lodge by one of the brothers. Somebody in the lodge, usually on Facebook, checks us all in.
Oh, yeah. There's always that person.
But he's not. But he's not there. Okay, so he's not actually in lodge, I guess, maybe.
Oh, that's great.
No, we have cell phones in lodge. We're particular about when pictures get taken, you know.
Yeah.
Or anything, but no. If you look at any given time during our meetings, you look around and half the brothers are staring down at their phones now.
Yes, and it drives me crazy.
And the other half are asleep. The old past masters are sleeping, and the younger brothers are all on their phones texting to each other in lodge about the grumpy past masters asleep over there in the north or whatever.
That's funny. So real quick, to paint a picture of the lodge that I went to, everyone talks so highly about this lodge. They're supposedly, everybody says they're going to raise 30 guys this year. Now, Chuck's internet is going down.
Uh-oh. I'm still here.
Oh, okay, hey, you're still there. So, hello. Now maybe before your internet's everyone... going down. Not my internet. Anyway, before we call them a degree mill, they're totally not. Some of the greatest, nicest people. So we get in there for dinner. Dinner is before lodge in Florida. And everybody holds hands, and chaplain says a prayer. And then we all say, you know, Samoda B and all that stuff. Then we all eat. There's about 6 or 7 guys inside the kitchen. One of the guys is actually an award-winning chef. So the food is actually really good. It's only $7, which is crazy. You're allowed to bring your wives. You're allowed to bring your girlfriends, your husbands, whoever. They're allowed to hang out for dinner. They're allowed to hang out for the flag ceremony. And then the worshipful master was really cool. He gave out pins to different brothers. He said, you know, and of course nobody knew it was coming, and this was an open lodge, so everybody could take pictures and all that good stuff. And he said, oh, I'm sorry, before lodge. And he said, you know, I'd like to give a golden key pin to a brother who comes here before everybody and he leaves before or after everybody else. And you're just such a key part of this lodge. So he has a little key pin, which is cool. He then gave like three or four other guys a pin in the shape of hands. And he goes, why hands? Because these guys are always willing to lend a hand. They're the first to raise a hand, and they're the first to extend a hand to a visitor. I was like, wow, that's amazing. And then they did a 65-year pin. That was amazing. And then they had like a fellow craft proficiency. They voted on like four people. They elected officers that year. God, I don't know. They did so many things that night. But yeah, that's been my highlight so far.
Great. Well, I was so late getting all of this started, and the real reason Bruce isn't here is I had the opportunity to have dinner with a very important executive, furthering my whole professional career thing.
Nice.
So I had messaged Brother Dunning to see if we could do this at 9 p.m. He was, of course, still available. He's been very amenable to our schedules. That was, of course, the last time in the day that worshipless producer Bruce could be with us. Again, with the grumpy mailman thing, he has to sleep sometime, I suppose. So the deal was that I was having dinner with these folks at like 5:30. And so I thought that'll be plenty of time to be here by 9. But we went to a French restaurant, and I forgot that the French like to eat dinner for like 4 hours. So that's where I've been and why this is so late. And I couldn't exactly squeeze out because I was, you know, brown nosing and doing what I have to do to further my client base. Yeah, other than that, the only big eventful thing was at home. Whenever my wife does something or misplaces something that I put somewhere on purpose, or my daughter changes the TV channel on me or whatever it may be, I've got this expression about, like, I live here. And I always just gripe about it. I'll mumble down the hallway, like, I live here. So the other day I thought I was going to be smart when she, like, took the remote and turned on Doc McStuffins. And I looked at her and I asked her, where does Daddy live? Thinking, of course, she's going to say he lives here and, like, make my point for me. So she looks at my wife and then looks at me and says, at Lodge.
Aww.
And I don't really know what to do with that just yet. I feel like that is an indication that maybe she was messing with me, or maybe she thinks I live at Lodge, in which case I'm doing something wrong. So I am in the midst of some real self-assessment about how much time I spend at my lodge hall this week. Yeah, but short of that, that's about it. Tony, we haven't seen you in a couple weeks. Where have you been?
I'm not surprised that Bruce is not on the show tonight. You can make up whatever excuses you would like to have for Bruce. I hope Bruce listens to the show. I have been fired as the chaplain of our lodge. I have not been reelected. As soon as Bruce goes into the East, the very first move that he made was to remove me from any office. He wanted to get rid of the chaplain, what we call it, a dynasty at the lodge?
Something like that. You and your son.
Right, chaplain's son. Well, and then the funny part about it, though, was during that same election that was not planned, a trustee of the lodge, my son is now a trustee, so we're a 2 out of a 3-member board that actually controls the activities, not day to day, but if anything wants to get done, the trustees can shut it down. I'm just wondering if he realizes that.
Oh, I'm sure he does.
So he fired me from chaplain and promoted me to a more powerful position, only I don't have to do anything. I could truly sit over in the corner and go, nope.
Well, I think your removal from the chaplain's chair had more to do with some of that speaking in tongues and the whole flying spaghetti monster costume you brought into lodge one day. And I'm pretty sure when you started burning books, that kind of cemented in his mind that that you can't do this anymore. Book burning has a zero tolerance policy here at our lodge.
Since when?
Since forever. Like when the Grand Lodge went on that campaign to ban some of the Masonic exposés and whatnot, like our lodge was one of the ones that rebelled. We don't harm books of any kind here.
Really? So when I was burning the look to the east, and everybody was throwing their look to the east in there, and a few of them didn't want to get rid of their look to the east, that was, you think that was an issue?
Yeah. Yeah. That's probably why he found someone else.
Oh, okay.
This is good, actually. For those of you who, who've been listening for a while, you remember landscaper Josh.
Yes.
And all of his appearances on the show. The angry chaplain was replaced with landscaper Josh. So I guess we're going to be Catholic now.
It's going to be kind of a mix between a Catholic and a voodoo religion. You're going to have the Day of the Dead and all that type of stuff now. So
true. He does have a lot of neck tattoos.
In all honesty, I went to Bruce before his year and said, look, I'll be glad to be your chaplain, but if there's anybody else that's willing to take the position, you will not hurt my feelings. And
I believe your words were, may this cup pass from me.
Yes, along those lines. So,
why does that work for chaplains and not for secretaries? I had to move to Florida to get out of being secretary.
So I made a few films that I'm not too proud of to get by in college. We all had to do what we had to do. And Bruce has a copy of those, and they've been passed from master to master, so I never get out of the secretary's desk.
We open our lodge with prayer, and we close our lodge with prayer. I guess I'm assuming that that's done in pretty much all jurisdictions, pretty much. Well, a chaplain can either last as long as he wants his chaplain or as short as he wants his chaplain simply by altering the length of his prayers. I've noticed that. And if I decide I want to get out of the chaplain chair, you extend your prayer to about 10 minutes long, and people will be saying, you've done a great job, but, you know, it's time to move on. So, whereas the secretary can get up and read the minutes, and it can be 30 minutes long. Nobody's listening anyway, because as we aforementioned, they're either the grumpy past masters are all asleep, and everybody else is on their phone. So they're not paying attention to the secretary. When we say prayer, you have to stand up. And so that's when people get aggravated, because now they've got to wake up, they've got to stand up. So the chaplain holds a lot of, is able to get in and out pretty easy. So, I mean, that's my whole take on it. Is that not pretty true? I mean, at most lodges?
I never really thought of it that way.
I have to stand up when I'm saying prayers. That's why usually my prayers are, thank you, Lord, and let's get home safe.
Yeah. Well, except for those times when you prayed at me in lodge.
Oh, yeah.
That happens.
In this most holy of holiday seasons. Well, let's not call it a holiday season. I don't agree with that.
So,
Okay, real quick. This is the time of year we always have to remember. About, I guess, 7 or 8 years ago, when our young brother Harlan was in lodge, and keep in mind, Harlan is of the Jewish tradition. And so in lodge, we had our Christmas tree. We said a regular prayer out there before we ate dinner. And then Harlan and his wife, a very sacred moment, a very nice moment. He was doing the traditional, him and his wife by themselves, lighting the menorah. They were lighting all the candles on the menorah. And one of our other grumpy past masters came up to him and totally innocently looked at him and said, hey, whose birthday is it? As far as like he was lighting birthday cakes. That's a true story. Remember, Harlan?
He started singing happy birthday.
Yes, yes. it was just so awkward.
So I'm listening to my wife like grunt in Hebrew under her breath, trying to get through the rest of the lighting and not like... I couldn't tell if she was going to scream at him or fall out laughing.
He thought you were lighting a birthday cake for somebody.
That's Jesus' birthday, man.
Yeah.
So, no, that is a memory that gets passed around this lodge. Actually, he was the first consumer. We got a copy of Judaism for Dummies to add to the lodge library. And I think he is one of the only people that pulls that out and digs through it. So, making good men better. One step at a time, more enlightened.
Hey, for our guest, or for your guest, I'm sorry, for the guest on the show this week, seriously, do y'all have any lodge stories like that where something funny happened or something, you know, it's like it's not a Masonic tradition, but it's something that happened in your lodge that just kind of gets passed down and I'm not embellishing that story. I'm toning it down, if anything. But do y'all have any stories that, like, just where somebody did something and it becomes like legend in the lodge?
Yeah, I'm sure that that's just pretty much common to the fraternity as a whole. And it's also in the Scottish Rite, too, I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, you going to tell us the story?
Well, I thought his internet cut out again. I was like, come on, man, tell us something.
But no, I think it's one of the things that over a period of time, you know, we all have a special bond to each other, but also the camaraderie and those type of stories actually help bond everybody together. Those common legends of an individual lodge. And I think bringing new people into lodge, the 30 people that this lodge is getting ready to raise this year, bringing them up to speed on those stories as soon as possible so that they feel part of that common history.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So what's your story?
I guess one of my favorite ones is that one of our brothers was, you know, very active in lots of different degrees outside of the Blue Lodge, both York Rite and Scottish Rite. And he was just one of those brothers that was very sharp. He had a good memory for the work and everything, but when it came to making signs, he never could get them right. And so you just never knew what sign he was going to throw. And every time he came in to approach the altar, everybody was on pins and needles and waiting to see what sign was he going to pull out of his hat.
Oh, man. That's so good.
Sometimes those get hilarious. We've got a fella that, to me, on one of the degrees, it always looks like he's throwing the high Hitler sign. The way he does the sign is just kind of,
yes.
You know.
Yes.
Our lodge has a lot of those stories, though. We've got the one where one of our extremely long-serving charter members, basically, when he actually died in the lodge. I mean, literally, he was sitting in his chair on the sidelines, just literally leaned forward, and he died right then. I mean, that's...
Well, the master wrapped everybody up. He stood up and then fell over, and that was it.
Yeah.
Wow. That's pretty crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We like showing the new guys that one because there's actually a tender spot in the floor in the south.
Yep.
He was a big fellow. Unfortunately, that's what happens when you don't have your annual physical. So for our brothers who are listening who are over the age of 40, when your doctor tells you need that annual exam, you should go get it.
Mm-hmm.
So that you don't end up just randomly dying unexpectedly one day.
Well, there's always new stories, too. Like when Harlan was our Grand Lodge representative, Grand Poopah, when he stuck his hand out trying to shake the brother's hand that had no hand. And Harlan kept saying, hey, shake my hand, brother, shake my hand. And the guy had no hand. So, you know, it's kind of like that story. You know, I felt bad for myself because I had no shoes, so I met the man that had no feet. That's kind of, this is the guy that had no hands. So
I can't bring that up. That's probably the most embarrassing moment I've had in my entire Masonic career.
So,
all right. Well, Brother Dunning, as is custom with our guest of honor, we always allow our guests the opportunity to kind of tell us what they've been up to since the last time they were on the After Lodge podcast. And a hint is the story begins, first there were dinosaurs. Carry on.
Okay, well, first there were dinosaurs. I think, some of the things that I've been up to lately, well, I just finally got the first copies of my book. The book was actually began being sold in the last week of November, and I'm only now, I mean, some of my readers got the book before I did. So that's kind of been what's going on with me, you know, in terms of things that are interesting. And then, of course, there's always something going on with family. My wife's got his 98th birthday, and he's a brother. He was in all three of my degrees going through the Blue Lodge. And he's a fantastic man. I hope that, you know, 10 years from now, I'm doing as well as he's doing at 98. He's
98. Amazing. And how long has he been a Mason?
You know, I don't guess I really know, but it's over 50 years.
Can you just imagine?
Yeah.
Like, I'm only 28, but I sit here and think about some of these older Masons who've been in Lodge 50, 60, 70 years and the things that they've had to go through in their Lodge and the topics that have happened, the world events, and they just still stuck together from it. Yeah.
Of course, the chaplain's face.
And it's my grandfather. Oh, yeah. My grandfather-in-law, you know, it's something that he still feels a lot of pride in. It's something that means something to him after all of these years. You know, he hasn't, it's not something that he just discounts as, you know, well, I did that back when I was younger and, you know, I'm done with it. It's still very important to him.
That's awesome. So did you come from a family of Masons, or what's your background?
Yeah, absolutely. My father was an active Mason, and my grandfather on my mother's side was a Mason. My father-in-law is a Mason, and then the church that I grew up in, most of the men there who were leaders and respected people in the church, respected men in the church, were Masons, and then we had Eastern Star all over my family as well. So I had an interest in it growing up, but my dad was of the generation that just didn't talk about it much ever. He was not at all afraid of leaving Morals and Dogma and Lightfoot's Manual of the Lodge out on the bookshelf where I could get into them. And so ever since I was a small boy, I have been, you know, peeling through Morals and Dogma and Lightfoot's Manual of the Lodge, trying to make sense of what I was reading, but just thoroughly enthralled by the mystery of it all. And so, yeah, I was bitten by the bug rather early. And then when I got to college, I took a philosophy course. Philosophy was my minor, and I took a philosophy course in the ancient wisdom traditions. That was the name of the philosophy course.
Oh man, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it was fantastic. My professor John Miller at the University of North Texas taught this course, and it was all esoteric traditions in the West, going all the way back to Pythagoras and the ancient Egyptians, and then moving up into modern time. And we had to do a term project. And by the time I was done with the term project, well, I had decided that I was going to do my term project on Freemasonry. And by the time I had done the term project, I knew that I was ready, and I asked my dad for a petition, and he practically ripped it out of his back pocket. And
unfolds it. He's like, I've been saving this for 30 years here.
Yeah, tattered and worn around the edges and sweat stained. And but yeah. So it's definitely a family tradition with me, and one that I'm very, very proud to be involved in.
Well, we are certainly glad you are. What I did not realize until I was, before it was brought up by Brother Riley, is that you were the author of the original Contemplative Masonry essays that were floating around the internet.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of that material, but I picked those up quite some time ago, and I didn't put two and two together really until I had ordered your book on David's recommendation, and I was reading through the foreword, and I was like, wait, this is the same guy? So, that's a big props for that, brothers. That's a
thank you.
That's something that my I guess, wannabe traditional observance lodge. I don't want to infringe any trademarks since we're not officially certified yet. That was one of the early materials that went around that lodge when it had first formed. So kind of cool to tie it all back. Our fraternity is humongous in some ways, and it's a very small world in others.
Yeah, well, it's interesting for me to hear that, and I'm glad to know that that old manuscript was getting some use. I know that when MasterMason.com put it online for me the first time and helped me, you know, essentially publish it anonymously online, I knew a circle of brothers that were all working with it, but you know, and I knew that it was kind of floating around out there, and still people were still able to find it in other places, but I didn't know, you know, that it was actually like. Gotcha. Glad to know.
Yeah. So how exactly, before we get, I guess, into too much of the content, how exactly did you get started, I guess, down this particular path? Because we, even today, one of my misgivings with a lot of the topics that come up at our festive boards, maybe it's just my particular traditional observance area, but it's everything seems so focused and bent on Hermeticism and Hermes Trismegistus, and it's a lot of the same content that was in your book when you talk about mindfulness and going down some of the practices that you describe in your book, but you managed to do it just with the symbolic degrees, which is part of what's so cool. But what made you go down that route to begin with? Did you have a history in this area, or?
Yeah. Well, when it comes to contemplative practice, I mean, it's pretty easy to start with the foundation of growing up in a fairly active church home. My house was right next door to the church that my parents helped build. And so prayer was part of my life growing up, and I was aware of the fact that I felt differently after I prayed and while I was praying. And that when I was sitting in church and listening to the choir, listening to the sermon, that I just remember recognizing that something was different about my awareness at those times when I was sitting still and listening and experiencing those reverent moments. And as I got older, I continued to kind of have an interest in things like meditation and spirituality of all sorts and comparative religion. But then, consciously, I was taking this course that I was talking about earlier in the ancient wisdom traditions, and through that, my philosophy professor introduced the class to meditation. He taught meditation in seminar outside of class, and so I started taking those meditation seminars with him. And at the same time, I was also beginning my work in mental health, and I worked at a substance abuse rehab where one of the counselors there taught me a meditative technique that was helpful in working with the people on my caseload. I was a caseworker. And so I would use this meditative technique to help people on my caseload deal with stress and anxiety and some of the challenges that they faced in recovering from their addictions. So it's like all of a sudden, actual disciplined practice became a real part of my life. And I just became aware of how valuable it was, how much of a difference it could make in a person's life, and how helpful it could be for me to expose other people to these practices. And so when I came into Freemasonry, I was actually hoping that there would be some sort of an esoteric contemplative tradition within Masonry, because everything that I read about Masonry suggested to me that it would have a lot in common with these other traditions, these other spiritual, esoteric, philosophical traditions, in which some form of meditation is almost universally practiced. And so I had hoped that I would find that in masonry. And I didn't. What I found was a lot of language that suggests that it's there and that, you know, Masons should be doing it. But no actual instruction or anybody, you know, practicing anything and passing that on. And so that's what got me motivated to, you know, to try to provide for others what I had been looking for myself.
Awesome. That's it's I don't even know where to really start with the subject itself. Meditation and the craft. I'm sure you have a better way of introducing the listeners who might not be familiar with the concept of meditation or mindfulness. More of why you feel that that's important in the lodge.
Sure. Well, I think we can go straight to the language of masonry for that. And, you know, most of our rituals, those of us who are in the Preston Webb family of rituals, most of us will recognize that our ritual can, you know, just repeatedly encourages us to practice contemplation. So there's this line that many of us will be familiar with about speculative masonry leads the contemplative to view with reverence and admiration the glorious works of creation and inspires him with the most exalted ideas of the perfection of his divine creator. Now that's a very common line. Most Freemasons have heard that at least once. And that line explains to us that if one of the things that we're looking for in our Masonic experience is a deeper appreciation for nature and a deeper sense of appreciation or a deeper appreciation and sense of understanding of God or of deity, then being a contemplative in our Masonic practice will enhance that for us, will enrich that for us. And so one of the things that I do in my book here is I go through the ritual and particularly at the monitor of Texas Masonry and show how many statements there are that reinforce this, that actually use the word contemplative or use the word meditation to emphasize that using our minds in a focused and intentional way benefits us very powerfully in getting the most out of our Masonic experience.
That reminds me, when I first, I think I was going through my second degree or something, and a bunch of us were late, Grand Lodge of Massachusetts, we had a park next door, down like six floors, run around, go up into the ninth floor, I think. Where's Corinthian, David? Ninth floor, right?
I'm a Cambridge Mason.
I'm a Cambridge Mason. Okay. Well, I think it's the ninth floor. And we were rushing around and doing what we had to do, get ready. And one of the guys stopped me and he goes, "Stop." And I said, "What? I'm late. I'm late. We got to start." He goes, "Stop. Where are you?" I said, "What do you mean?" He's like, "Stop. Where are you?" I said, "I'm in the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts." He's like, "What are you doing?" And I said, "I'm here to take a degree." He's like, "What do you feel? You know," and this and that. We would go through all these things, and then we would take a couple deep breaths, and he would like, "Open your eyes." And he's like, "Are you ready?" And at that moment, it's like being awakened for the first time, and you're like, "Okay, whatever you just did, we have to talk a lot more about later because I need to know how to do this." But I think you're saying something to the same point.
Yeah. That's there. A pretty good description of mindfulness, of being present right here, right now, conscious of what I'm doing while I'm doing it.
So, Brother Chuck's in the published version of the book, which we'll, of course, link to for those of you who are wondering. You lay out a series of exercises going through the 3 degrees, the themes of the physical, emotional, mental, spiritual. Just because they caught my attention, I started at our last lodge meeting to begin with the Entered Apprentice exercises and see how, because this is markedly different from some of the stuff that I do in my other lodge. And thank God there's no alchemy involved here, so it's all good. One of the things that I noticed right away, and this has done me a major service because I didn't even realize it was an issue, is when I was getting my start in the lodge and when I first started going through the chairs, I was here every time the doors are open. And even at a business meeting, when I knew nothing of great illumination was going to happen in the meeting, I still remember standing up in front of my chair during the opening of the lodge and this whole act of consecrating the space we were about to meet as a tiled lodge in. And I remember that feeling that you had when the gavels would drop, and it was almost like you could feel the room being elevated to a different mental plane of existence, like that this place was now separate from the world. It elevated is the best word I can come up with, this feeling of just like literally my body feels like we're all lifting up together. And it was because I was paying such attention to the ritual and I was so engaged in what we were doing as a group. Well, this past meeting, we've mentioned earlier, I'm the secretary of my lodge. And so I tried to pay attention through the opening ritual. But then what I realized is during part of that, during the meeting, during some of the degree work, I'm at my desk. I'm shuffling through papers. I'm trying to seal dues cards and record cash transactions. And there's a lot of times of late where the master does that typical thing that the master does in every lodge when he loses track of what's going on.
Just and looks says, at the
brother secretary. Here I like to call that the eyes left maneuver. I kind of like the military when they do eyes right, like it's a snap of the head. Brother secretary. And I wouldn't even know what's going on. And I'd have to look up and figure out where we're at. And it's something that just happened through being the secretary. But I never really noticed that it was happening until I was attempting to do the beginning exercises from your book. So even if I don't manage to pull anything else out from this, that realization alone, it remains to be seen, but I expect that it will have a major impact on my immediate future in Freemasonry. Just that reminder of do some of the stuff before and after lodge and jot down the minutes when you have to, but otherwise like leave the desk alone while there are more important things happening. So thanks.
It is so easy. Oh, you're welcome. And I'm glad there was something there useful to you. To get our consciousness scattered, be juggling all sorts of different things and trying to kind of just go on part autopilot and part attention divided among several different things. And when we're doing that, there's just something that we not only need to experience, but need to do. And so, slowing down enough and focusing consciousness to be present right here, right now on what's actually happening here and now, particularly in a sacred space like the Masonic Lodge, can be, just that little bit of effort can make a huge difference sometimes.
How do you bring that about throughout the... You guys are talking about a lodge that I've never really set in. Not that our lodge... There's times that we open and the work is good, and oftentimes, and you are engaged and you're watching what's going on. But more often than not, as you're opening and going through the ritual, you look around the lodge, and like I talked earlier, guys are on their phones. There's some guys that they're talking among themselves, or they're making jokes about the, you know, it's really not a reverent opening. And I like a reverent opening, but typically you don't necessarily see that often. And then as you're going through the lodge business, I've been in a lot of lodges, just like Harlan's talking about. He's over there doing his secretary work. And I've seen where the secretary and the treasurer were over there conducting business while lodge proceedings are going on. And it's almost like they're a separate part of the lodge. You know, they're not they're not engaged. And like what you said, it's a very good point of being, I'm present with my employees when I'm at work, or with my bosses, or with my customers. You're actually present, and I try to actively do that, you know, consciously do that. At lodge, I don't know that I actually do that. I mean, this is a really good point for me to sit here and listen to this.
That's a really good point to say. Yeah.
Well, thank you for saying that I had a really good point.
You do have a really good point, and I think that it's probably more often the case that most people's experience of lodge is what you're talking about, is that somewhere along the line, the idea that the lodge is supposed to be a place set apart from our profane world, which means not only the people outside the lodge, but our own profaning. So the way that people on a regular basis is not the way we want to interact with people in a Masonic lodge. That doesn't mean we can't have fun. It doesn't mean that we can't joke around a little bit, but it also means that we really want to make it to be really present with each other. And so, yeah, to answer your question, I think one of the things that happens in some lodges is that they do start with a period of silence before they begin opening the lodge.
And
you know, that's not always going to be the case. And so one of the things that I think is an important point here that I would make is that the benefit of these practices will come to an individual if he does them on his own, even if the rest of the lodge is not doing them. It can lead to a lot of insights. I mean, you can start to learn a lot about yourself as you experience your reactions to what everybody else is doing or not doing. And you know, it's very, let me just speak for myself. I mean, you know, there have been times when I have had a fairly kind of judgmental attitude, and particularly early on, when I, you know, had a mind full of shoulds about the way the lodge experience was supposed to be and the way it should be, and getting angry and disappointed that more brothers weren't invested in making base and being present. And I got in touch with my own judgmentalness about that, plenty of opportunities to work on it.
It's funny you say that. What I'm relating it to, what you just said, is religion.
Yes.
That basically, if you're in lodge and you think lodge should be a certain way, well, then that's the way that you should probably act. But now if you start expanding on that and saying everybody else should act this way, well, now you're going to end up just basically offending people. Now, you can do maybe some stuff one-on-one, but if you start saying everybody's got to be quiet, y'all are being, you know, I think there's a balance there that you have to really be mindful of, you know, worry about. And I think that's one thing about being the chaplain about religion today is I have a religion. And so in order to do it correctly, everybody's got to do it the way I believe in doing it. So there is a balance there as far as how much play. The second point I wanted to make, and it just occurred to me when I joined, not just occurred to me, but when I joined lodge, you have certain expectations. And as an EA, and the first time you generally close an EA lodge, that's the only part you see. In our jurisdiction, you have to go, you have to do an EA. We do everything on the Master Mason degree. All business is done on that degree, okay? Mm-hmm. And so we'll close an EA lodge on a degree, and then the EAs have to leave, and then we'll go back to Master Mason. When you're raised as an EA, right, generally, that part of the closing, that ritual part, is done fairly reverently. You know, it's usually done, you know, very, very well. You stick to the ritual. Once that EA is gone, when you're closing down the MM part of it, usually everybody's ready to go home, and so you just rush, and you don't really get into it. So you see that as an EA, though. The only part you see is the formal closing. The only part you see as a fellow craft is the formal closing, because you actually don't even see the openings on those. And then when you're actually raised as a Master Mason and you're full of, you're ready to go in for the esoteric and you're ready to go in and learn these things, and then you sit through your first lodge meeting as a Master Mason, and it's done very casually. It's done without the formalities. All of a sudden, you're like, wait a minute. This isn't what I thought it was. And so I think we can lose new brothers simply by being too relaxed. They're looking for something different.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, I mean...
Well, wait a minute. You're supposed to say good point first.
Yes, it is such a good point. I'm struggling for words.
Okay. But, I mean, do you see that, though? I mean, I think that may be...
Yeah, absolutely. No, absolutely. Because one of the things that you're drawing attention to is that if our seriousness, if the seriousness and the solemnity with which we perform a ritual is just done for show, to try to drag along these younger guys until we get them to commit to being Master Masons, they're going to see that. They're going to say, oh, this has just been a pretense. This has just been a farce. This is not what I'm looking for. Yeah, it's an excellent point.
Yeah, and then, two or three meetings in, they find out that we're just a bunch of good old boys having a club meeting rather than really following the ritual and digging. And when you go to a meeting, you expect to have training or to dig in deeper to some of these points. And then when the only thing you do is talk about what bills need to be paid or when the next chicken dinner is, we're not bringing all of a sudden these. That's not what you thought you signed up for, you know.
Right, right. Yes, good point.
Good point.
So as we've been sitting here, I was thinking back to what moment could I think of as the most centered, I guess, the highlight of mindfulness for me in the craft. Where was I the most present? And what immediately sprung to mind was after I was installed as master of this lodge, the first time we did an entered apprentice degree and I conferred this degree, and I don't think I have ever been as in the zone, if you will, inside the lodge than that particular night. There's a lot of jokes that float around here about Harlan being a robot and emotionless and soulless and all that jazz. But that night, like, brought tears to my eyes as I'm making this guy I've never met, changing his life, making him a Mason. But what it got me thinking about just now was, we always talk about light coming from the east and the master being the light bearer, in it, for lack of better phrasing. I can't think of anybody in the lodge room who should be more present, more engaged in the ritual and the workings of what's happening than the guy sitting in the east.
Right.
It's almost like the course that you lay out of contemplative study. I'm thinking about recommending it. Well, I already have recommended it to our senior warden. Bruce is being installed as master on Saturday. But allow them to build up to that so they can almost have that culminating moment of where you are in what I think is the best position to really go into that single focused presence of mind, that this is where I'm at, this is what I'm doing, this is all that matters. Because I mentioned that one night during the EA degree, but really the entire year I was master, I don't recall many of those moments where I lost focus on what was important during the lodge meeting. Like, you're almost compelled to go into that contemplative practice being master.
There's two different... Harlan, one thing I want to interject here, though, is me and you both took vastly different paths to the master's chair. When I joined the lodge, and I'm sure other lodges are like this, we were shorthanded on officers, and some lodges get to where they just recycle past masters. You know, who's going to be master this year, because they don't have a progressive line or new blood coming into the lodge. My first chair that I had was junior warden. The next year I went to senior warden, but our past master kind of bailed on us halfway through the year. And so I've been a Mason for actually active in lodge for like a year and a half, and I'm sitting in the master's chair opening and closing lodge with not a clue what I'm doing there. And I think that's a downfall that we need, that sometimes we tend to rush the brothers through the chairs. And that, I feel like that's what happened to me. Harlan is the first brother that we had in our lodge for a long time that actually made the travel, that took the route all the way around, sat in all the chairs, mm-hmm. and did all that. And so you have sometimes we have a master that you don't even realize what you're doing until 3/4 of the way through, and then you realize, man, it's the year's over. And sometimes we put unprepared brothers into the master's chair is what I'm saying.
Hmm.
Well, maybe there's an argument to be made, at least from the subject at hand, that that kind of maybe that expedites that focus, that mindfulness, that attention to detail and what you're thinking and feeling. I don't know. I've never done that. But Brother Chuck, what do you think about the master's chair as a position for contemplative practice?
Well, I actually think all the offices offer opportunities for that, and each in a unique way, because each office represents abilities, and with abilities comes a different kind of mindfulness, different things that, as you know, as the junior warden or as one of the deacons or one of the stewards, you have different responsibilities to the lodge, and those are things that your attention should be particularly focused upon. And when we're performing a degree and putting a candidate or a brother through a degree experience, that's particularly true of the three principal officers and the senior warden, the senior deacon. Each of them plays a very important role, and being fully present in that role and understanding what it is that role is supposed to be facilitating on behalf of the candidate or brother going through the degree is a very important contemplative practice.
You know, that might actually be a good training program for a year at lodge, that every chair would take a different meeting, and the junior deacon would stand up at one point in lodge and explain why he says what he says, why he has that role, what that role consists of, and that would help that officer learn more about his role and keep everybody. Most people, when they're in the chair, I think they're looking to the next chair. They're not really engaged right. in the chair they're in. They're always looking forward to what they're doing next year, not what, right. not really where they're at.
Yeah, and Tony, you know, something you said there that makes a lot of sense is talking about how so, for example, the senior warden might take some time to explain what his role is and kind of, I mean, that's what we do ceremonially
right.
at the opening and closing of the lodges, is that the significance of those stations are explained in a ceremonial way, but that just becomes kind of rote
yes.
recitation. And we need to be able to put that in our own words and to say it in a way that's not as symbolic but more literal about my actual function in the working of the lodge.
Mm-hmm. I was a Mason for quite a few years before I realized what the meridian height was. You know, different things so that you can get into the more esoteric parts of your position if you explain why and how it came to be that way or what you're actually doing.
Right, right. Yeah, in our Masonic catechisms, the questions and answers that we learn for proficiency in lots of jurisdictions gives mm-hmm. us lots of opportunities to do that. I mean, what most of us do is we just learn to memorize the question and then memorize the answer right. in response. And we're not encouraged to say, okay, now what did you, in your own words, what did you just say?
Mm-hmm.
And what does that mean to you? And I know that there are lodges out there that do that, but I think it's the exception rather than the rule. But that mm-hmm. is also an important or easily, readily available opportunity for contemplative practice in ordinary Masonic experience.
Well, I had a very good lecturer that taught me how to memorize the proficiencies, and how to do all that, but we never really in between learning the proficiency, we didn't talk about the proficiency. We talked about the weather or whatever was going on. And so it took me a long time to learn a lot of those things. When I was lecturing my son, what I would do is we would go through the lecture, and then what we would discuss is, okay, now in modern day language, what does that mean?
Exactly, yes.
And, oh, interesting.
And then when we did the proficiency, when I was teaching him the proficiencies each other way through, basically I would tell him, I'm going to ask you questions, but it's just a conversation. And the whole handshake, the whole everything, when you're going through the rope, you don't really get it. But basically, you're being tried, and I'm asking you different questions that you may be asked anywhere across the world, you know, as far as why did you become a Mason? You know, what is the answer to that answer?
Yeah. David, sorry, go ahead.
I'm just trying to stay away. I'm trying to stay away so I don't break any obligations going in as far as actual questions. But you know what I'm saying? When you're going through the process back and forth and you're asking those questions,
yeah,
it's a conversation between two brothers. It's not necessarily a test type thing.
Yeah.
And that's the way everybody takes it, is that I have to pass this test. So.
Well, and understanding what you're saying makes it a great deal easier to memorize.
Yes.
In my experience. When I have done candidate education, and I would say that if you go to my mother lodge, somewhere around 70% of the active members of that lodge, I did candidate education. One of the things that I did is stop and at various points stop and explain, or stop and have a conversation, depending on how appropriate the approach is. So that they really have an understanding of what they're saying, because rote brute memorization is possible, but it's much more work than understanding it so that when you say it, it makes sense to you.
Well, the whole year I was in the master's chair, I had the rote memorization down, but I didn't really have a lot of the meanings behind it. And that sounds bad. I'm just being honest. You know, I could open and close the lodge, go through the whole ritual. But if you dug very deep on me, I would not have been able to answer very many questions. So,
I think that's one of the problems that we have in Freemasonry, is that we skipped a couple of generations of good Masonic education, and there are a lot of men who've never been offered the opportunity to really learn the meaning of the words. They've been taught that they have to memorize those words, but what they need, why we do the things we do, and the significance of it and how it's supposed to work hasn't been given to them. And so, unfortunately, now we're in a situation where we have leaders who are afraid of people who want to explore that because they never had the opportunity to learn that. So they react badly when other people express an interest in it. So, like, I was remembering, I don't know if you remember this, you told me one time that one way to preserve mindfulness in lodge is to watch the candidates very carefully.
Yes.
And I had this moment during a degree where it was a very hot night, and my mother lodge doesn't have air conditioning. And I was walking to do the same part for the third time that night, and my wool tuxedo was soaked through with sweat. And I was not in the best mental condition I've ever been in at that moment, I will admit. And I reached up and touched the candidate's chest, because I was required to do that for the part. And I felt the candidate's heartbeat underneath my hand. And I don't know how better to explain it other than to say it shocked me into the moment.
Yes.
And to this day, if you, at any time there's degree work going on, because of that moment, I remember the moment, and then you'll catch me watching the candidates like a hawk. And that has been such a gift to me as someone who's, you know, you see those degrees over the course of your life hundreds of times. And I know there's people out there who wonder how we can still get anything from it. But if you watch a candidate,
yes.
And, every single time the candidate will react to something. Like, there'll be a facial expression or a startle or an indrawn breath or something. And it will have never occurred to me. I will suddenly have a new understanding of a piece of the ritual because of the way the candidate has reacted to it. It's such a fascinating practice, and I want to thank you for bringing that to me.
Oh, well, my pleasure. I'm glad that was something that was so significant to you at a moment when, you know, things could have gone in a very different direction for you. You know, I think it's true that connecting, I mean, really, when we're performing a degree, the most important person in the room is the candidate. And I think sometimes we lose sight of that, and it's easy for us to get into some other space about why we're there or what we're doing, or to be thinking about, I really want to be out of here because it's hot, I've been doing this all night long, or whatever. And we lose sight of the fact that we're there performing a service for another human being that it has taken some pretty significant risks. And is opening themselves up with a great deal of faith and hope. And when we can reconnect with that, when we can have an experience of empathy with the candidate, that does have a tendency to just snap us right back into what's really going on and why we're really there.
So on the note of candidates, some of the chatter going on in the IRC channel were some fellas talking about when they took the degrees, how they were left in the ante room for extended periods of time, which is not uncommon, and were forced to engage in some meditation just because they were out there forever. This begs the question, which is an After Lodge favorite, which comes up with the famous, infamous, depending on how you look at it, Chamber of Reflection debate, which our lodge uses as a place to put the candidate to almost compel that sense of reflection before you embark upon Freemasonry.
Right.
I guess I just never thought of applying that to contemplative practice, or that meditation is what's going on in there, but we have our new initiates. You know, they go in there and they have to answer the standard questions. They write it on a parchment about man's duty, etc. And in there, just the way the room is set up, you don't have any choice but to lose your focus on everything else and be brought present in the moment.
Yes.
Which we had been... Oh, pardon me. I think we've been looking at it not directly that way, but it is definitely an added benefit. And I think some of the things we've heard from initiates and new Master Masons since we've started that practice kind of reinforce that. So it's a new way. Brother Dunning's book, for those of you who are thinking of picking it up, or the essays floating around on mastermason.com, might be a new spin on the age-old... can we have a chamber of reflection debate that a lot of you are having in your lodges?
So, Brother Dunning, do you think we should have a chamber of reflection as part of our degrees, the same way we have it in Knights Templar, whatever?
You know, my personal preference is yes, but I also respect that every lodge has its own culture. And so I think this is something that each lodge should be able to decide on its own. I think you don't have to have a traditional European style, or what we now think of as a European style chamber of reflection, or
right.
You don't have to have that. That is naturally conducive to certain kind of meditation before entering in the degree. It definitely brings certain things to mind. But, you know, my own experience in the preparation room before my entered apprentice degree was I was divested. I was set down in a chair, and then I was left alone in there for a while. And and I could hear things going on in the rooms around me, but I was alone, and I was, you know, in that condition that candidates are in when they're waiting. And just having that time alone to be still, to not have to talk to anybody, to not have to, you know, observe the social niceties and norms of just casual interaction with people, allowed me a moment to get into a different frame of mind. Now, of course, my studies and my background prepared me to take advantage of that, but it's going to have a natural effect like that on just about anybody to some degree. I think more important than having a chamber of reflection set up with, you know, with the usual kinds of things that you find in a classic chamber of reflection, more important than having all the physical things there is to let the candidate know that this is a time and a space in which they have the opportunity to get centered, to get focused, to prepare themselves mentally, emotionally, and spiritually for what's about to come, even though they may not know what's about to come.
That's a great idea.
I definitely would have benefited from just being left alone. I remember the night I was initiated, I was in there with the stewards who were cracking the usual jokes that you crack on initiates before they come in about undergarments and all that jazz. And smoking and joking, and everybody was having a big old time, and then we went in the door. So I definitely did not walk into the Entered Apprentices Lodge for the first time having spent the time to center myself. I did receive that opportunity before I was raised, but I think leaving the candidate alone may be the best takeaway. Even if you don't have a chamber, just leave the guy alone.
Yeah, leave him alone and let him know that, you know, he has an opportunity here to prepare, to make that shift. And it doesn't, you know, you don't have to give him a whole lot of instruction in meditation or anything at that point. Just let him know. You've got some space and time by yourself to make a shift and get ready for what you're about to go through.
Right. If you had to pick which degree out of Blue Lodge would be the best degree to be mindful and aware and get the best return for your investment, which degree would you choose?
Oh man, Nick, I mean, I don't think I could do that.
Oh, come on.
Each one of them to me is just so rich and so full of symbolism and not just symbolism in terms of imagery or words, but the movements that happen in the lodge I just think each one of them is a gold mine. I'm sorry, I hate to let you down, Nick, but that's the best I can do.
Let me down.
Well, wouldn't the Master Mason degree added later? Wasn't it the first two degrees that were the main degrees?
Yeah. Originally, I mean, you know, basically there was just an initiation, in fact, I think I want to say there was a point at which some provincial Grand Master in England was a fellow craft, so yeah, the Master Mason degree came along later, but you know, it has been said that all the degrees after the Entered Apprentice degree are just elaborations upon what you learned in the Entered Apprentice degree, and I think there's some truth to that. I think they're wonderful elaborations, and I think that they are at times more than elaborations, but yes, the Entered Apprentice degree is absolutely indispensable, of course.
Well, Harlan's fond of saying that, and I agree with him, is that the Fellowcraft degree is basically looked over. That's the degree in between your coming in and your getting done. And it's actually a lot more to it. And I think we all do that. I think we skip over the fellowcraft degree in our haste to get them Master Masons. So,
well, I would agree with you on that point. My biggest issue with the way a lot of lodges do degrees is, okay, I have a, I have my part. Boom, I said every word correctly. Go. Boom. And then they get to the next guy, and the guy's like, and he says the words so quickly. Mm-hmm. And you, the reason I personally don't like the fellowcraft degree, because it's just, here's a fire hose, get ready. And then you launch the guy, and then you're like, hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk about it like one more time, but that's it.
But we do that. I think that's our fault in our haste, because every lodge that I know of has some major thing, whether it's a Thanksgiving morning masonry or a raising, or different lodges have different, you know, this is our annual bean and cornbread night. We want to have a master mason raised. And so I think a lot of times we rush, it's our fault, we rush them through that degree. And if you actually stop, I mean, this is where you get your wages. This is where, you know, there's a lot of things to the fellowcraft degree that we don't really fully discuss and explain.
Yeah. Well, Chuck, you say in your book, in the Inner Work of a Fellowcraft chapter, you say that in the fellowcraft degree, you have been encouraged to develop your mind. We tend to think of the mind as our conscious awareness. However, there is far more to the mind than we are ever entirely aware of at any given moment. And you go into this, and you go into all these different aspects of the mind, and it's just such a great way to go through the fellowcraft.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the things that that I understood about the system is that there's this progression through the hierarchy of the psyche, through the 3 degrees. The Entered Apprentice degree deals with, primarily focuses on our physical and emotional levels of being. The Fellowcraft degree deals more with the mind, the intellectual aspects of being. And in lots of very intricate ways. I mean, you just think about liberal arts and sciences, for example. Each one of those things engages the mind in a different and yet highly meaningful way. And so the fellowcraft degree is just, I mean, we even talk about polishing and adorning the mind, right? That's ritual language for a lot of us. And so the fellowcraft degree draws attention to the importance of what we do with our mind. That's kind of behind everything that we've been discussing here so far, is that are we bringing our full attention to what we're doing? That's an exercise of consciousness. And one of the points that I make early on in the book is that of all our working tools as Freemasons, our first and most basic working tool is conscious health. You think about that. If we're supposed to be workers and involved in a builder's art, and our most basic working tool is not the thing that we actually develop real mastery with, because it's the one we have to use in order to use any other working tool. If we don't develop real mastery with that most basic working tool, then we're never going to get the most out of the other ones that we possibly can.
Hmm. Interesting.
I like it.
So, I got to say, so we had your friend and David Riley's friend, Bob Davis, on last week.
Yeah.
And before I forget, I have to tell you, there was a part in the warm-up where Harlan's like, I got to admit, I didn't read the book, but I have a really good reason why. And he's like, I'm addicted to C.R. Dunning's book. He's like, I can't put that thing down.
You know, Nick, we are never to... We're never to speak of what happens pre and post show.
Oh, but it's so good. But it's so good. You could edit that little minute out.
No, it's good. It's good. I did plow through that text rather quickly, and then I did it again. Just because, for me, like, one of the grievances that I lodge with I think it's my own and a lot of lodges that are affiliated with the Masonic Restoration Movement, is this almost obsession everywhere I go with Hermeticism and alchemy and yeah. And while those things are cool to study and it's part of as a fellow craft, expanding your mind and being able to do comparative practices, it gets presented in such a way as though this is Freemasonry and this is the material we're going to use. Mm-hmm. And what Brother Dunning illustrates rather eloquently is you don't need any of that. We have more than enough stone to begin erecting these temples in the three craft degrees.
I think one of the things that you know, I came into Masonry a guy who was very much in love with these esoteric traditions. I mean, I've studied a lot about alchemy and Hermeticism and Kabbalah. I have practiced within those traditions, actually done meditative work within those traditions fairly extensively. But as a result of being so deep into those traditions, one of the things we come to realize is that it's all symbolism.
Yep.
It's all symbolism. Different words and images to try to approach and grapple with the same mysterious things about our own existence, about the world, and about God. And so if we understand that Freemasonry is a symbolic system that addresses all of those areas just the way alchemy does, the way Hermeticism does, the way Kabbalah does, then we can recognize the opportunities that Freemasonry itself provides for us. None of us has to go out and become a Kabbalist to be a good Mason and to get everything out of Masonry that it has to offer. Can Kabbalah help us find interesting things and maybe learn more? Of course it can. It can definitely enrich our experience, but it's not necessary.
Right. And also, I don't know that the Masonic Lodge is equipped to deal outside of the three degrees. I say this in that Kabbalah is something that's near and dear to my heart. But when I want to study the Kabbalists, when I want to know more about that, I head over to the synagogue. Mm-hmm. That's where I find that. When I come to Lodge, I'm here to study and practice Masonry. And so when we so often go off the course and get into these other areas, it's not in any way besmirching them as areas worthy of study. It's
right.
Just, I don't know that the Lodge is even equipped to do that. Like, I've seen Kabbalah taken out of context in so many places. When you're not equipped to teach it, you're doing a disservice to the candidates trying to learn. And I think when Freemasonry tries to engage in practices that aren't Freemasonry, however well-intentioned, you may even be doing a disservice to the men trying to study that. We're not equipped to do that. We're equipped to do Masonry.
Yeah, and I think one of the, you know, you were talking about something there about distracting. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that can happen that's unfortunate is that a man comes into Freemasonry, he's excited about what the tradition itself has to offer and the richness of the tradition and all of these great minds through history that have been inspired and motivated by our tradition. And you know, he comes into a lodge where there's a reputation for people doing things that are on the esoteric side of stuff, that get into these deeper levels. And the first thing that happens is basically he's told, well, ignore all of that stuff. What you really need to be paying attention to is this other tradition.
You're right.
That's just an injustice to the...
I think you made a comment a while ago that I don't want to say it bothered me. It's a good point. but talking about symbolism.
Yes.
I think a lot of times we shortchange. Symbolism is a way that we explain things, or a way, you know, one picture says 1,000 words so that you can understand. I think a lot of times we just, when somebody has a question, we just say, well, it's symbolism. It's symbolism. We don't go into the deeper meaning. And concerning new people coming into lodges, you know, we don't explain what the symbolism is. It's a picture of something, and we don't go deeper into it. It's just a quick, it's a quick answer. Another thing I think though too is when people join the lodge, they don't necessarily join so that they can work the fish fry, or lodges function. And I'd kind of disagree with what Harlan would say is that. The function of a lodge is to make masons, okay? But it's also to make it help understand. And I think in the present days, a lot of lodges' functions are to work fundraisers, that we spend so much time on trying to keep the doors open that we lose our focus. Like you say, being in the moment, we lose our focus from studying the deeper meanings and doing that. And all of our energy is put forth toward the next breakfast or the next fundraiser or whatever, that we don't spend enough time on those things. And so you end up losing some new brothers that were expecting this and got this. So.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
So a little bit to that point, because I know there's prospects, there's candidates, entered apprentices, fellow crafts, new master masons, and very old wise masons. Everybody listens to this show. It's an amazing show. I know there's going to be some people listening, be like, tell me how to do this. I'm about to go through my degree next week, tomorrow, whatever. How do I do this? So what can you walk these guys through, or maybe somebody that's going to be sitting in the East or a senior degree or whatever, and be like, how do I become mindful right then?
Well, if of course the price is right, we will unveil this knowledge.
That's right. Of course, my first answer is buy my book. no, that's not that. That's actually not my first answer. But of course, I want people to buy the book. I mean, there's so many wonderful exercises in there to enrich the experience. And quickly, I just want to say on that note that all of the proceeds from the sale of this book actually go to the Guthrie Temple Restoration and Maintenance Fund. I'm not making a dime off of this book. So I want people to know that when they purchase this book, they're actually helping that wonderful temple in Guthrie. But to get back to your question, Nick, A really simple understanding of mindfulness is like I was saying earlier, it's about being really present right here, right now. And there are a couple of ways that I teach people to do that very commonly. And I actually don't mention those in this book, but I use them often when I am teaching group meditations. And the first is to just become aware of the feeling of gravity. Just become aware of your body right now. Feel gravity pulling down on your body. And relax a little. Let yourself relax into that pull of gravity. And as you do that, then pay attention to your breathing. Become aware of your breath just flowing in and out as it naturally does. You don't have to change your breathing. You don't have to do any kind of special breathing technique. What happens doing these, you're mindfully focusing in where you are. And then you can make the shift to just being really aware of what's happening in your own mind and with your own feelings. And then you can ask yourself, is this what I want to be thinking about right now? Is this the way I want to be feeling? Are these the attitudes that I want to have? Or do I need to make a shift so that I can be more effective in the way that's important for me to be effective right here and right now? So just to recap, gravity, breath, and then taking a kind of personal inventory of what's going on with me right now, and is this what I want? Is this what I need in order to be able to do what I intend to do?
Now, in order to do this, do I have to be in a sitting position with my legs crossed and my hands on top of my knees with my fingers touching? I'm just curious.
You do, Tony.
It sounds like you're describing yoga. But no, and I agree with what you're saying. I really do. I think it's good stuff. But it's actually almost like I was going to ask you, but you kind of answered it there. I was going to ask you as soon as I got an opportunity to describe, when you talk about meditation, what do you mean? Just leaning back in your chair and thinking about things? Or I think you just did it. So,
well, yeah, let me talk a little bit about terminology really quickly. So one of the reasons that I named this book Contemplative Masonry is because contemplation is a little bit more, in common language, is a little bit more of an umbrella term than meditation is. And what I want people to understand is that what we're talking about here does not necessarily mean that you have to do what you were describing, Tony, which is to sit in some really awkward position for most of us in the Western world. Yeah. And put yourself in lots of pain and maybe peril of not being able to move for a few days. Sure, there are benefits if you want to follow that tradition and learn how to do those things and achieve some of the milestones of development in those traditions. Of course, there are benefits from that, but it's not necessary in order to get a richer experience of masonry. When I talk about meditation, very often what I'm referring to is some sort of formalized technique of focusing awareness, of focusing consciousness in a particular way for a particular task. In that sense, there are a lot of things that most of us do on a daily basis that are a kind of meditation. If you sit down to write an email, and in that moment you are focusing your thoughts on exactly what you're trying to say to that person, and you're not letting anything else come into your mind, that's a kind of meditation. You've got focused, an intentional focus of awareness. And so every time I talk about meditation or contemplation, essentially that's what I'm talking about. It's like I'm going to intentionally focus my awareness in this particular way for this particular time and this particular purpose.
Well, there's your free bit of guidance. And as the folks from the local Grand Lodge Philanthropy say, this is the last free thing you will ever get from the After Lodge podcast.
I appreciate all that. I know there's going to be a lot of people listening that are definitely going to try that at their next lodge meeting, and I'm sure we'll hear it in the IRC. And somebody actually in the chat room just said, and I bought his book.
Very good.
Well, thanks.
How can we buy your book?
It's available at Amazon.com and also at Barnes & Noble. You can order it through either one of them. Its retail price, I think, is $12.95. And that's a pretty good deal.
And what's the name of it? I'm sorry, what's the name of your book?
It's Contemplative Masonry: Basic Applications of Mindfulness, Meditation, and Imagery for the Craft.
Reverend Brother Tony, you should buy the book because not that we're receiving a commission off of this or anything, but if you, before it gets shipped or whatever, we have a copy here in the Lodge Library, so check it out there too.
I'd like to buy the book for Christmas presents for Masons, I know, so that's my plan.
I thought maybe you wanted to read it.
Well, I do want. I will buy myself a copy. One other question I have, though, is: do I have to buy it off Amazon, or can I just send you a check? Because I'd like to have a signed copy.
Yeah, sure. We can work that out.
Oh my goodness.
Well, what's wrong with wanting a signed copy? Well, one day, if I outlive him and he dies, the value of that book would then go up. So
that's true. Well,
brother, I got all the, what I got is all the, what is the cost of a perpetual membership at the Valley of Guthrie? And wouldn't that be the price of a signed copy of your book?
David Riley, everybody. Dropping mics, like usual.
I'm a fundraiser. It's what I do.
I thought the chaplain was taking a dig at me because after Brother Davis's interview last week, we talked about doing a Facebook campaign to raffle off a signed copy of a Mason's Words. I, without excuse, have failed to make that post on Facebook. So I thought that's what Tony was getting at. I blame Bruce because he's not here and because he's the producer. But we will be rolling that out this week. So you can find that on our Facebook feed and get your signed copy of A Mason's Words. And as you just heard, if you want a signed copy of Contemplative Masonry, you need to buy a perpetual membership.
Well, can you put a link onto the SnoozeNet or on the on our Reddit channel?
Yes.
Or something? Because I'm
yes,
a, I have not been in the moment. I've been watching. I finally figured out how to get on the SnoozeNet, and I've been reading that while you guys are talking. So I apologize for not being in the moment.
Yes, we will, of course, put all the links to all the things.
Oh, there we go.
You'll have to pardon the Reverend. This is his first episode of the After Lodge podcast.
It's the first time he's used the internet, apparently.
No, SnoozeNet is for computer savvy people, and I use an iPhone, so I don't have to figure nothing out, anything out.
Oh. So. I was going to say in the 90s it was the primary means of communicating with people on the internet, but no one remembers that. Okay, well, does anybody have anything else? I don't want to keep anybody too late.
Yeah, Harlan, there is one more thing I would like to say, and that is that, you know, I really see it as a kind of personal mission to help spread the practice of contemplation, contemplative practice within Masonry. And so if there are lodges or other Masonic organizations out there that are interested in having workshops or having me come do a presentation or something like that, I'm very open to working that out. And welcome people to contact me. I've got an email address for that purpose. If anybody's interested.
Absolutely. I think you're jumping ahead of all of us, but we were definitely going to get to that point. Be like, go ahead and give everybody everything.
I have a quick question. How long has this book been in print?
A couple weeks.
Because I'm looking at the Amazon page on my computer right now, and it says paperback is $12.95, but there's three used that you can get for $11.68. I'm thinking, man, what? Did they read this book that quick?
Yeah. There are book dealers out there that will buy them and then resell them. They buy them at a discount rate and then resell them at what looks like less than retail price, but they're actually making a little money on them.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they add $4 shipping to them.
People like myself who don't have a lodge where they can dump their Masonic literature when they're done with it have wives like my own who say I have far too many books and some of them have to go. And so what a lot of folks do is they'll read a book and then turn around and take it to Barnes & Noble or to wherever and trade that book back in.
Yes.
For some credit, and I think some of them end up on Amazon as used through that because their wives won't let them have more than a few shelves of books.
Well, and just so you know that for your next book, I'm more than willing to do the foreword on it. So.
Wonderful. That's a good idea.
You know, he was just contemplating that earlier today. So I have one more thing. If, Chuck, if we have time, if not, I know it's getting late.
I'm good.
Awesome. I'm reading a little bit about you. I have it up on one of my screens here, and it says, in 2012, you became the founding superintendent of the Academy of Reflection.
Yeah.
Wait, hold on. David, why are you laughing about that? Wait, there's a story.
Because no, it sounds like a made-up thing.
When that was going to come up, because I like Chuck's story about starting the Academy of Reflection, but this is good.
Let's go. Let's do this. David, this is why you're here. Why are you waiting till the end?
Well, Nick's right. It's a made-up thing. But it's a chartered made-up thing, so, you know, that makes all the difference.
Ronnie Seal said it was okay. He stamped it.
We've had a long-standing educational that's been longer ago now than I want to try to figure out that Jim Tresner and Bob Davis invited me to come and start participating in the education program there. And they knew that one of the things that I was particularly involved in and interested in was this contemplative stuff. And so they welcomed me to make it available to the brothers. And so I started offering group meditation sessions, usually in the early hours of the morning on the weekends of the reunions before the degrees started. And, you know, I think the first time we had like three or four brothers that showed up and everybody was yawning and shuffling around and laughing about, you know, they weren't sure if they had made the right decision to get out of bed yet or not. And then we had a meditation and everybody walked away from it feeling positive and thinking that it had been worthwhile. And we had another one, and then we had another one, and before you know it, and so one of the younger brothers comes up to me and he says, "You know, Chuck, we need to make this like official somehow. This needs to be a thing." And I said, "You know, I think you might be right." And so I went and had a talk with both Jim and Bob, and they agreed that it was time to do something. And so I asked them what they thought about the idea of creating an organization that like other organizations within the Scottish Rite, like the Knights of St. Andrew, for example, existed for meeting a specific need among the brethren. The Knights of St. Andrew is a service organization. It's for Scottish Rite Masons who want to do service. What about Scottish Rite Masons who want to do contemplative practice and make that you know, like a real regular part of their Scottish Rite experience? Well, sure, let's do that. Let's make an organization. And so I drafted up a proposal for this and went back to the guys that had been attending these meditation sessions and said, let's go through this proposal and make sure that it's what we want. And before we knew it, what we had was, a pretty detailed plan for, in effect, a society and a school of contemplative practice within Scottish Rite Freemasonry. We presented that in 2012 to the board of the Valley. The board approved it and sent it on to the SGIG of Oklahoma, the illustrious Brother Joe Manning, and he looked it over and issued us a charter, and that charter was issued in September of 2012. January of 2013, it was presented to the brothers, the charter brothers, and we had our inaugural meeting and performed our induction ceremony for all our charter members that were present at the time, and it has grown. We have continued to induct new members. We've got two valleys out in California now that have academies in formation. Probably within a year and a half, both of those will be operating academies on their own. And so and there are other valleys around the country that are interested in forming their own academies and getting chartered. And so the Scottish Rite is kind of a natural place for this sort of thing to happen, for lots of reasons. But one of my hopes is that these Masons who find the Academy of Reflection as a kind of home base for their contemplative practice will then take it into their Blue Lodges as well. Because it belongs in the Blue Lodge. It's not something right to become involved with.
The website is academyofreflection.org. You guys are also on Facebook with a couple thousand likes and all that stuff. One thing you touched on, and a gentleman on the chat room, House Lannister, had asked, and I think you had touched in the beginning of this show, and he says, how do I start shifting the mindset of a lodge from fundraising and business over to philosophy and esoteric? He continues with, we currently have one brother who does our required education in the lodge, but all it is a short article about something Masonic, just enough to check the box. Mm-hmm.
So he wants his lodge to be doing Freemasonry?
Well, that goes
David Riley, ladies and gentlemen.
I was making an earlier point of that tends to be the focus of a lot of lodges, is we tend to focus more on our fundraising efforts than we do on our Masonry efforts. So,
and if we would attend more to the Masonry, the fundraising would go better.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I guess to address this brother's question more directly, I wouldn't expect any quick fixes. That one of the things that can happen is since there's already some interest in education, is showing that historically these are things that Masons have been interested in, and that the actual, you know, like the heavyweights, when we look back in Masonic history and we look at the heavyweights that influenced our ritual and the development of our ritual, people like Preston, and even further back than that, There's growing scholarship to show that they were interested in these deeper things, in these philosophical things. I mean, Sean Iyer with the Philalethes Society has been doing stellar work in amassing evidence that our early 1700s Freemasons were interested in these deeper aspects, and that's what they were all excited about. That's what made Freemasonry take root and grow and become what it became. And that's what also this younger generation of Freemasons, that's what they're coming in looking for. And so here we have both the past of our art and the future of our art, both calling for the same thing, which suggests that the present is the place where we can make that transformation happen. And so if we can just begin by drawing attention to those two things, that it's part of our past and that it will be part of our future if we answer the call of this new generation, then slowly the change will begin to occur, because it will be a survival mechanism, if nothing else.
Wow. There comes a point in the last like three shows where the guest will say something and it's just complete silence while we just take in everything you said, and then we have imaginary fights with our lodges in our head.
Yeah.
Now, see, if producer Bruce was here tonight, he would be yelling at us about dead air time and dead air and the danger of dead air and stop it. So, because this is a internet radio show, after all. So, somebody say something? Anything?
Well, yes, David.
I'd just like to take the opportunity, Chuck, because if I tried to do this in person with you, you would run away. So I'm just going to take the opportunity to say how grateful I am that you've been a light in my Masonic life and journey, as I know you've been to so many brethren. and that you're a genuine ornament to the craft. And I'm very grateful to you for this book, but also just for the way that you approached this topic, which was, you know, it's so easy to become judgmental about our brethren who are fish fry masons or pancake breakfast masons, or our brothers who are wrapped up in the fundraising, or our brothers who, you know, are stuck in a 1950s mindset of what the lodge is as a social club. It's easy to become judgmental about them, but to be able to introduce this topic in such a non-judgmental, accepting, and gentle way is a real gift from you. And I for one, am genuinely appreciative of it and grateful that you are doing this work.
Thank you, David. That means a lot to me, because I haven't always been that way. Like I was explaining earlier, I got a good look in the mirror at myself early on in my Masonic experience. I didn't like what I saw. You know, one of the most significant things that has developed in my appreciation of Masonry is understanding how important love is. How sensitive is to everything that Freemasonry, and you know, if I'm talking about esotericism and I'm talking about contemplation and I'm talking about meditation, and I'm not doing that in a loving way, and I'm not communicating that enhances the experience of love in Freemasonry, then I'm just wasting my time, and I'm, with my own religious background in Christianity, I'm reminded of that first, you know, part of the chapter 13 in 1 Corinthians, where Paul talks about, you know, I can work wonders and speak in tongues, but if I don't have love, it means nothing. And so thank you very much. If no other message gets out of this podcast, I hope that's the message that resonates most deeply with everybody who hears it, is that's what this is really, really all about, is love. And if we keep that as our touchstone, as our guiding light, then we'll make the right decisions and we'll do the right things.
Absolutely. That's even more on point with your book, when you're talking about contemplating on the themes of the degrees. We talk about faith, hope, and charity being the principal rungs of the path to enlightenment, and that the greatest of these is charity. And I think somewhere the etymology of charity got lost to mean philanthropy.
Yes.
But as you point out in your book, charity and love are essentially synonymous terms. That when we speak of charity, we are talking about that charity towards your brothers, of giving them the benefit of the doubts, of loving them in spite of your differences, always assuming the best to their intentions whenever possible. And I think you guys summed it up better than I did. I just wanted to sound smart by linking that charity thing back.
No, I think that's a great point. Absolutely.
Yeah. I actually have that highlighted somewhere in here, and I believe the word love is in bold, but I can't find it right now. And I've went through like 10 – what chapter is it in? Do you know offhand?
That's in my preface.
Well, why would I check the preface for something that awesome?
Nobody ever reads the preface. I know.
That's why it's called the preface. Well –
you gotta start from the beginning now.
You not read the foreword either?
Nah, I read the foreword.
Yeah, because Dr. Jim Tresner wrote the foreword. You don't want to miss that.
There. Boom. Right there. Page 20. By the way, page 20 should not be the preface. That's like chapter 2 already. And he goes, I've come to note... crap. I gotta go. Even so, there's one major addition to the contemplative exercises offered in the previous editions. The inner work for the Master Mason degree now includes an exercise that focuses on what I've come to know is such a central theme of Masonry that I'm almost ashamed to say I largely neglected it in the early editions. The theme is love. Now, I'm not going to read the whole chapter, but it gets a lot more awesome from there. And we actually have somebody else in the chat room that just said, be right back, buying the book.
So it's not always easy to do that. I'm sure that Brother Chuck's not the only one to experience that, kind of toning down that instinctive judgmentalism towards your brother, and isn't always easy. No. I still struggle with it a decade in. Again, it's that always assuming the best of intentions on the part of your brethren is the thing I always have to come back to. That we may disagree, but we both want what we think is best for the craft and best for our lodge. And in his mind, that's more pancakes. In mine, it might be something else. But that there's nothing necessarily malicious or anything that should cause internal angst about that, and yet it does.
Yeah.
So I suppose that's a never-ending struggle to keep yourself leveled.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's important for us to have conversations about what do we really want. You know, for a lodge, you know, for brothers to just actually be able to sit down around a table together sometime and say, okay, what is it we really want for this lodge? And what do we think are the important things to do to get what we really want for this lodge? And to just have that conversation and to let people know, you know, our brothers know ahead of time that there's not necessarily going to be any wrong answers. That it's okay for different people to want different things, but that it's worthwhile for us to try to come to consensus and then work together on that consensus. And that different ideas about how to do that, whatever that agreed goal is, the different ideas about how to do that will arise. And that just because one person has a good idea doesn't mean that necessarily rules out the other good ideas, that there can be more than one approach to success.
Wow.
Hey, well, not to keep banging the drum about the hour growing late, but Worshipless Producer Bruce is normally the one keeping tabs on the time. So I definitely don't want to cut anyone off. If there are any more questions.
Let's give a second for the chat room. I feel like we could continue talking all night about.
I think it would be nice if you could have a follow up show with the same people on to give people time, because there's a lot to digest in this episode.
Yeah, man.
And of course, we'd be more than open to doing that. This is the After Lodge Roadshow. After all, we're on tour. We can stop in somewhere else again. Never a problem. Or you could just. You get roped in, like Brother Riley has, because you can't think of anything else to do on a Tuesday than hang out with me. And I can't say I fault him.
I just do whatever Nick tells me to do. So, you know.
I was mentioning that before in the chat room earlier this morning when I was like, you and I were talking. You're like, oh, let's do that tonight. I'm like, no, David, you have After Lodge tonight. Tomorrow we're doing this. Thursday we're doing this. And Friday night we're getting pizza. I should check your calendar.
I didn't know I needed a personal assistant, but I'm glad I have one. Yeah.
I was going to make a secretary comment. So,
anyways, Brother Dunning, the floor is yours. Close us out. Tell us how people can get in touch with you, how they could learn more, everything you're into. Go ahead.
Okay. First, let me say thank you to all of you guys. I mean, every one of you. You know, Chaplain Tony, it's been wonderful meeting you here and hearing all of your really good ideas. And Nick, I appreciate, you know, you digging into the book and out some particular things that were said there and asking some really good questions. David, it's always a pleasure to be with you. And, you know, I'm glad that we have had as much Masonic contact as we've had over the years. And it's wonderful that this is now another one of those ways that we get to interact with each other. You're a great friend. Harlan, it's been a pleasure meeting you doing here. And I'm very open to being helpful in the future if you want to do a follow-up show of some kind. If people want to contact me, they can do that at chuck@thelaudablepursuit.org. That's chuck@thelaudablepursuit.org. And, you know, The Laudable Pursuit, they have a competing podcast with you, but there's room for everybody in the Masonic fraternity, is there not?
Yeah. Well, I feel like when you say compete, it's as though our shows aren't always this enlightening. So we often try to fill the void in the Masonic podcast world of that that after lodge chicanery, where you don't really learn anything, like, but somehow you leave with a smile on your face.
That's good stuff.
Yeah, the other shows on the air, I listen to them all the time, but all of them, when I'm done, I walk away and I feel like I've learned something. But sometimes you don't want to learn something. Sometimes you just want to giggle.
Yeah.
So.
Good for the soul.
Yeah, we haven't done that in a few weeks because Brother Riley was on the show, and then he has contacts with other enlightened men, and so we've had a nice run of late of very intellectually stimulating shows. So thank you for that. Thanks for working with my scheduling stuff too. I know I threw a lot of changes at you right at the last minute.
No problem, really. It's not been a problem at all.
In my classic coping mechanism that nothing can ever be my fault, I blame the French for that, and Bruce for everything else, and and thanks Obama for whatever I missed. So, yes, everybody's fault but mine.
U.S. mail is partially at fault, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. That's the other thing, is thank you to Worshipless Producer Bruce for your service to these United States in making sure that everyone gets their Christmas gifts on time and safely, and getting out in the blistering cold at 4 a.m. to do that for us. So with that, if there is nothing else to come before this After Lodge table. All right.
For the 20th time tonight.
Yes. So this puts a lid on episode 150 of the After Lodge podcast. Brought to you from the secret corner of the Googleplex, where we siphon off the bandwidth to distribute our pirate radio podcast to all of you clandestine Masons out there. You can find the show notes for this or any previously published episode at www.afterlodge.com. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at After Lodge. Shoot us an email at afterlodge@gmail.com. Hang out with us on IRC, which, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, if you weren't doing tonight, well, you missed out again, so hang out on IRC. No, I'm not going to publish a advanced schedule outside of IRC. The whole point is that you're there and hanging out with your brothers, not just showing up to niche the link for the podcast. So come hang out with us. It is a good time. And of course, you can find us, as always, on the Freemasonry and After Lodge subreddits. So until next time, brothers. Well, this is where I normally do a catchy ending, but Bruce didn't prepare that for me either. So we'll see you next week.
Good night.
Bye. You can't